There's a lot of like words floating around out there about these types of markets right now. And the biggest one I would say is saturated. And for me, yes, I mean, there is such a thing as saturated, of course. But I kind of look at short-term rentals. So now we're an established asset class. We're past the early adopter thing. We're established, just like long-term rentals, just like apartment buildings. And I kind of think of the short-term rental asset class as being like the younger sibling of like apartment investing.
Welcome back to the Real Estate Law Podcast. Jason Muth here with Straightforward Short-Term Rentals and Pride Away Stays. We have an amazing guest today. We're going to talk to Avery Carl. I'm so excited to have Avery on this podcast. She and I have been in rooms together, and she didn't know that I was there watching her because she was on the main stage talking to lots of people, imparting tons of wisdom about short-term rentals and investing in general. I mean, if you are a real estate investor, if you followed the podcast world and a lot of education online, you've probably come across Avery and her content. Avery and her husband, Luke, right? Luke is your husband. He's like, you guys are all over my social media feed. Maybe it's because the algorithm loves to feed me a lot of short-term rental content. But Avery legitimately wrote the book on this, Short-Term Rental, Long-Term Wealth, as a Bigger Pockets contributor. She's been on the main stage at Bigger Pockets. I just saw you, I think you were presenting, right, at the STR Secrets, our Short-Term Rental Wealth Conference, right? We were just in Nashville. Yep. And what I love about, and she does the short-term shop. The short-term shop is like, you know, this is a really big deal in the STR world. You guys have represented thousands of buyers in a number of amazing vacation destination markets. You know, you really know your stuff and you're a rocker at heart. That's kind of the one thing I love, right? So, well, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Real Estate Law Podcast.
Thank you.
All right. So what I was just looking at your website. I love how you got your Megadeth t-shirt on and your husband has the Iron Maiden t-shirt on and all your agents look all prim and proper, just like their typical headshots. Right. And you know, I told you earlier, I don't normally come underdressed. I got my Providence Civic Center t-shirt on and I changed my background because you got some of my 80s and 90s, like, you know, CDs and cassettes right there. Got some Bon Jovi and everything, Adamant Live. Like I used to be on the radio back in the day. So like my world before short-term rental world was all media. Back in Providence, at this venue, I saw Tesla and Firehouse back in 1991. And yeah, I still love Tesla to this day. I bet you're a Tesla fan.
So I don't love Tesla. I do like Firehouse.
All right.
Tesla, I mean, I've seen them a bunch of times. They're just like, They don't do it for me, but I do like Firehouse, which is funny because Firehouse is like a lot more, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, cheesy hair band than
80s rockers. But so Tesla started as that though. Like, you know, back in high school when Love Song came out, like that was a big hit on MTV. And then they put out Five Man Acoustical Jam. And I swear I listened to the album so much. And I'm not like that kind of rocker, although I appreciate it. But back in my early radio days was the early part of grunge, you know, so like Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, all that stuff. So I have a deep appreciation for that type of music. But, you know, your stuff, are you big into hair bands?
So I love classic rock and classic metal. I do love hair metal. I definitely have a special place in my heart for that. Classic punk also. So basically, and I mean, even like getting into like the post-punk goth stuff. So really, basically, I mean, I love classic country too. So basically, if it came out before like 92, there's a good chance that I like it. So
like,
yeah.
80s alt rock, like Susie and the Banshees and the Smiths and all that? Like, really? Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, I've seen Morrissey a few times. I've never seen Susie, but
I would have never thought that. This is an all reverence, but like you've always reminded me of Lita Ford whenever
Thank you. I'm a big Lita Ford fan. Big Joan Jett. Big Runaways fan. I have a Joan Jett tattoo. So,
I interviewed Joan Jett back in the day. There was a photo of me and Joan Jett somewhere. Yeah. Backstage at the Strand. She did one of our shows back in the radio days, but you know, like we all had this world before short-term rentals. What was your world before you were in STRs?
Okay. Bit of a lengthy world. So my husband Luke and I both were in the music business. He still is. He's just kind of dropped down to part-time to just do it for fun. So he was up until 2 or 3 years ago on 12 hours a day on SiriusXM, Hair Nation, and Ozzy's Boneyard. Now he just does the weekends. And then for me, so I toured in bands as a guitar player and a bass player for several years after undergrad. I graduated from University of Texas in 2019. In 2009, not 2019. I wish. 2009, which was like the worst time in the history of the world to graduate and be able to get a job. So I'm like, well, I'm bartending and continuing this music thing, which is cool because, you know, I graduated at like right before I turned 21, the week before I turned 21. And I just blew through college because I wanted to party. And so rather than party during school, I was like, all right, I'm going to just finish all this really, really fast and then party. So I bartended and played music for several years, touring a bunch of bands. And then went back and got my master's degree. I met Luke when we lived in New York City. We moved down to Nashville in like 2012, 2013. Went back and got my master's degree. And then I was working on the business side of music in Nashville, which I thought was going to be awesome. So I thought it was going to be a bunch of people like me who had played music. You know, we did not become famous. So, you know, but people who had similar interests in, you know, having a quote unquote big girl job, but also being into music. But it was a bunch of dorks that were willing to, you know, make very, very, very little money a year. I was one of them. I was making like $37,000 a year to do this job that is very sexy. And you get to say, yeah, I was in a room with Keith Urban last night, but I was like, you know, who the fuck cares? I don't even like that kind of music. So I was a little bit of a millennial jerk in my corporate days. And we kind of ended up in real estate because of that. But that was my life before.
But you figured that out early, though. And I give you a lot of credit for doing that. I mean, like, I worked in the media business for over two decades. And I got a little, you know, it was sexy, right? Being on the radio back in the 90s was cool. Mm-hmm. Alt rock was awesome back then. Like, I was supposed to go to med school. Went to a great college. On I go into this world of the media business and ended up working for iHeart for a long time in their research team. And then I did a couple other jobs on the sales side because I realized that there was more money on the sales side, as you probably figured out too, yes, in the real estate world. But you know, you stepped away from that like $37,000 a year, cool, but not lucrative career to work your way into the real estate world. And if you just graduated into that recession back in 2009, you know, I joined Bigger Pockets in 2015. When did your book come out with BP?
Book came out. I wrote it in 2020. It came out in 21.
Okay. So like, I want to put this timeline together for people who are listening to this. So like, you finish college, you're doing all this stuff in Nashville, you're doing these jobs that aren't paying a ton of money, but are really fun. And then you find your way into real estate. And suddenly in 2020, you are a published author with Bigger Pockets, which is not easy to do, to get their attention to do this. So somewhere along the way, once you find your way into real estate, you accelerated quickly, where you had to transition away from what your identity was to what your identity is now. I mean, I only know you as this. But since I know there's a rock side to you, I had to learn that other side of it as well. But tell me, how hard was it to transition away from that other world into becoming this real estate expert where you legitimately are an expert? You're not one of these people online that, you know, like they do it once or twice and suddenly they're an influencer. Like, you know, you have such a big track record right now. How hard was it to make that transition? And when did you really kind of feel comfortable that this is the world that you feel like you belong in and can speak really well to?
Oh, well, I mean, it all kind of happened organically. My husband and I both have which sometimes a good thing, sometimes a terrible thing, very obsessive personalities. So, you know, if we're going to do something, we're going to do it all the way. We're going to go to the end of that thing. So, I mean, he's been very successful at everything he's ever tried. Like, he was bartending in New York City. He owned a bar in New York by the time he was 25. I, you know, grew up in Mississippi, which is not a state that has a lot of women's soccer going on. And I got super obsessed with soccer. And then I ended up playing college soccer at University of Texas on a scholarship and Big 12 championship. So, you know, got super into music, which, you know, my useless talent is I can, you know, I know all the words to like every song that came out between 1960 and 92. Not every song, but in the rock genre, most of them. So that didn't really get me anywhere other than, you know, impressing people in meetings sometimes, if they're the right type of person, like this meeting. But we both have those very obsessive personalities. So when we got that first rent check, so we started with long-term rentals. We bought a long-term rental in Nashville, and the rent was about $1,000 over the mortgage every month. And when we got that first rent check, we were like, man, that is about the same as what I make in a month after all the deductions from my job. And so we've just doubled my income with one house. Let's do some more of this, because I was always trying to think about, like I'm a very morning work person. And so what I would do in my corporate jobs, I'd get to work and I put my head down. I get to work at 7, finish everything by like 11. And I'm just waiting for somebody to give me something to do, but I'm just sitting here for like hours of my day. Like, okay, I mean, can I go to the gym or something? You know, you can't leave. And so I was starting to get very bored, which is making me very unhappy, because I would classify myself as like a working dog. And if I don't have anything to do, then I start chewing the furniture. And so if we realized we could make double my income with just this one house, what could we do with 20 of them? So we thought, well, what can we buy that's going to make us the most amount of money the fastest? And keep in mind, you know, Luke had a regular job, but I had a not really making much job. So we were all right financially, but we only had like, I would say like another, I can't remember the exact down payment, but we had enough of a down payment that we could only buy one more single family house. We couldn't go buy an apartment or whatever. So we said, what can we buy that's going to make us the most amount of money the fastest so that we can scale faster? And we landed on short-term rentals. We didn't want to do it in Nashville at the time because all the regulations were very anti-short-term rental. Like, are they going to ban them altogether? And we couldn't afford to make a mistake like that. So we said, well, where can we go and buy something that's like the normal thing for people to come and rent a house or a condo or something privately owned other than a hotel? That's like the normal thing for them to do. And we'd just been to the Smoky Mountains for the weekend. We'd stayed in a cabin. Everybody else that was there was staying in cabins. And we said, well, somebody owns these cabins. Why can't it be us? This is way back. This is in 2015. This was before there were gurus. There was no AirDNA. AirDNA, I think, started the same year that we started. There was none of this stuff to tell you how to do this. So we just kind of figured it out. And that's where it started, was how we ended up in real estate. Yeah. To make a long story long.
You know, our first short-term rental was in 2016 in New Hampshire. And, you know, we certainly haven't scaled to the level that you have. We personally have 4 in New Hampshire and 1 in Provincetown, Mass. But, you know, I've heard you speak at other podcasts about leaning into these classic vacation markets where there is a culture of short-term renting these properties. And I realize that not all the ones that you've represented are in these types of markets, but I think you and I kind of found our way to that market because, you know, people have been renting in the Smokies for decades, right? I've never been there myself, actually, but I just hear so much about it online. Same as New Hampshire, same as Cape Cod. People have been renting these places for so long. There is such a culture of having it be a second home or a vacation market. It doesn't mean that it's easy and it doesn't mean it's unregulated, but it means there's precedent, right? And, you know, I think in the podcast I listened to you talking recently about the growth of short-term rentals and the future of short-term rentals. And how do you feel about these kind of markets as being the places that people should be looking these days?
That's a great question. So there's a lot of like words floating around out there about these types of markets right now. And the biggest one I would say is saturated. And for me, yes, I mean, there is such a thing as saturated, of course. But I kind of look at short-term rentals. So now we're an established asset class. We're past the early adopter thing. We're established, just like long-term rentals, just like apartment buildings. And I kind of think of the short-term rental asset class as being like the younger sibling of like apartment investing. And you know, there's all these people out there, people that want you to give them money to tell you where to invest, saying things like, oh, you know, don't buy in Panama City Beach, don't buy in the Smokies, don't buy in Joshua Tree, like all these places that have historically been really good places to buy because there's a lot of rentals. They're like, they're saturated. There's too many. You can't make money, which is not true. You know, you don't ever hear the multifamily asset class people saying that. They don't say, oh my God, there's too many apartment buildings. We can't, it's apartment building bust. They buy where there is a need, where people want to live. So for example, Austin, Texas or San Diego, I lived in Austin back when it was cheap, but it's not anymore. So the real estate in those areas is always going to be more expensive than the real estate like in Memphis or Gary, Indiana, because those are places that everybody wants to live. Really, you know, San Diego, really great weather, lots of jobs, lots of reasons people want to live there. So it's always going to be a good place to buy long-term rentals in San Diego because that's where people want to be. Now, the thing about that is because the real estate is more expensive, that makes the cap rates, which for those of you who are not multifamily investors who are listening, makes the cap rates lower. So the higher the cap rate, the better the investment. Well, where you see really, really high cap rates, and I promise I'm about to swing it back to short terms, you see really high cap rates in areas that aren't as desirable, like Memphis, small towns in the Midwest, places like this. And what I've learned for myself is that I have bought these purely, when you're looking only at the data, at the cap rates of best places to buy, I have bought these kinds of rentals in the Midwest. And I'm currently selling 24 units in the Midwest because I bought only for the cash flow and I didn't really have to do a lot to these units. But what's happened is because the area itself, it was kind of an up and coming area, medium-sized metro area, kind of transitional neighborhood, which was getting there. But what happened was the big apartment building next door, that landlord just let it completely just go to crap, did not screen tenants in any way, shape, or form. It eventually became a squatter situation. It eventually became condemned, and it's right next door to ours. So it's affecting the rentability of our units. And for me, like we're just having to sell because we're losing money every month because people don't want to rent next door to this crack house. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with short-term rentals. So people are like, oh, you know, the Emerald Coast is too expensive, or these places are saturated. They don't make sense. And in short terms, we look for cash on cash return. And they're like, well, I got to go to this other place that nobody's ever heard of. I got to be first so I can have the cash on cash return. I got to be where there are no rentals. So it's the same thing as looking for those high cap rates when you're looking for areas where there's just higher cash on cash return just laying around on the MLS. You can potentially have that higher cash flow, but at what cost? So for me, I will never not buy in a place that doesn't have a lot of rentals because I am in my mid-30s now. I have inexplicable back pain and I'm just too tired. I don't want to mess with having to trailblaze. And I don't care what the cap rates or the cash on cash returns that are laying around on the MLS are. I'm going to use the same strategy that we use in multifamily investing. You pick the good market and you look for the opportunity in that market to buy a property that maybe needs work or that's being mismanaged to get it up to that cash on cash return number that you're looking for. I want to buy in a good market and find the opportunity to get a property there, then find a property that's already there in terms of cash flow, quote unquote, or cash on cash return, which those two things are kind of the reverse of each other. But I want to buy in the market where I can get it there rather than buy in a market where the cash on cash return is already there, but the market isn't. Because at the end of the day, let's say Panama City, for example. I live next door to Panama City and 30A. Any of these areas, 30A, 8 million visitors a year. There's only 10,000 of us that live here. I would much rather buy a property here because our season is from March to the end of October. I really only have to get about 50 of those 8 million people a year to book me. So I'd much rather be fishing in a barrel like that where there's tons and tons of tourism and there always has been than be, you know, you might be the only hook in the water in a huge pond where there's not a lot of fish. So Anyway.
How do you feel about the return on equity metric in that conversation? Because I've been hearing that a lot more of late. You know, back in the day, it was all Burr strategy with bigger pockets and buying in those Midwest markets that a lot of people bought multis, you know, in the Rust Belt. And now things have kind of pivoted a bit where, you know, I've never thought that you should buy because of the equity upside. That's always the bonus. But I feel like people are talking a little bit more about looking at the overall picture beyond just cash on cash.
So I don't look a lot at how much the appreciation potential is so much as the stability of the market. So I just want to see that I'm not going to make the same mistake that I made with this 24 unit of, okay, the cash on cash return is here, but is the market there too? So I don't really, if I get appreciation, that's great. We've seen a lot of that. We've gotten really lucky with timing in terms of when we've bought properties and, you know, COVID and everything. But that's not usually my first goal. So I just want to be in a very desirable market for my short term. So these are areas with a lot of tourism. I want high tourism traffic markets. And if I get a good amount of appreciation, that's great. But for me, I'm looking more at cash flow at this point than cash on cash return. So guys, why I keep kind of using those two different words is that, you know, the higher your cash on cash return, the lower your cash flow is going to be, and vice versa. So if you put down 30% on a property, your cash on cash return is going to look worse, but your cash flow will be higher because your mortgage is going to be less. Whereas if you only put down 10%, your cash on cash return is going to look great because you're only putting down 10%, but your cash flow is going to be lower because the mortgage is higher. So I'm looking more, when I first started, cash on cash return was more important to me because I didn't have much cash. So I needed the highest return possible on that cash. Now that we've got, I think we've got right about 200, once we sell this 24, you know, about 226 doors. I'm really more interested in how much cash flow is this going to add to my income every month.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like, you're also looking at your portfolio as your life is changing and as things are, you know, appreciating in many places, and you're making adjustments. What's working, you know, in the past might not be the same strategy today. And I hope that if you're listening to this and you kind of take that advice, we're doing the same thing. I mean, like, we're selling one of our non short-term rental properties, knock on wood, it closes. We're under contract with it now, which is great. But, you know, basically that was just a lot of cash that was sunk into something that I couldn't really earn a great return on. So we're trying to pull the cash out to get a better return somewhere else with that. And you're right. It was the calculus was good a couple of years ago, but now the calculus means let's do something different. Mm-hmm. In all your markets, you know, so you're, talk about some of the markets that you are in first.
So I personally have investments in the Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, Destin, Florida, 30A, Florida, and the Forgotten Coast of Florida. So Cape San Blas. But the short-term shop, we have real estate offices in 20 markets. They're all vacation markets with the exception of two that are like kind of half metro, half vacation, or maybe three. So like Scottsdale, the Orlando, Kissimmee area, and then the Sarasota, Bradenton area, I would call those vacation-ish.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of your markets appear on lists, right? Like whether it's a invest in this list or don't invest in this list. And the lists change every single year, right? I mean, people are putting lists out there and then everyone goes and runs at that list.
Right.
But, you know, the good news about having the short-term shop and kind of what you've built with that business is it's pretty dependent upon transactions, right? You know, so whether you're going to buy or you're going to sell, you're there to be the expert in both those situations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Tell me, what are people doing right now? And maybe it's market dependent, but are you seeing more people that are listing their properties in trying to get out of the short-term rentals? Are you seeing more people coming into the properties, either new or adding onto their portfolios? What's kind of the customer flow looking like?
So the average short-term shop client buys 4 properties with us. And what we're seeing now, we're seeing more people selling because a lot of people got into this in 21 and 22, just because the interest rates were low and they were like, oh, wait, the payment on a beach house is how much? I'm just going to buy one of these because I can afford that payment and I'm going to slap it on Airbnb and it'll make money. And they didn't really treat it like the business that it is. So we're seeing a lot of those people get out. And then we are seeing less buyers, but we're seeing them more buyers in cheaper areas because that the bad interest rates, the high interest rates are less noticeable on a cheaper property than a bigger one. So we're seeing a lot of people buying in our cheaper markets. So Myrtle Beach and Branson. And then it's kind of like the middle of the road where people have kind of like filtered out a little bit. And then we have people buying like huge 1.5 to 2 million plus properties because those are the people who aren't necessarily worried about the interest rates. They're going to ride that out and refinance later. Mm-hmm. So I would say the low end and the high end of the market has kind of stayed constant, whereas the middle has kind of filtered out off some.
Mm-hmm. And since you've been seeing this with short-term shops since what year did that begin?
2019.
Okay. So the investors that you worked with in 2020 and 2021, you know, kind of right after COVID hit, and then, you know, that really first year of us figuring out what was going on, what's the difference between the people that are now selling and the ones that are now continuing to operate because it's working well for them?
The difference between the people who are selling and buying more is, I think, you know, there's a certain sect of people that I call like asset class hoppers. So whatever's the buzzword, like, oh, I'm going to buy a bunch of short-term rentals right now. Oh, you know what? I'm going to buy self-storage right now. And then they'll end up with like one of each thing, but they never truly like scale at any of it. A lot of those happening right now. We've got a good amount of people who are selling to reinvest in a 1031 exchange into bigger things, who maybe started with like 3 or 4 bedrooms. Now they've got some equity and they want to go bigger, like 6 to 8 bedrooms. So I don't know. I don't know what the difference is. I think it's a lot of the same people that are selling 1031 exchanging. I would say a lot of the newer people who are brand new to this, buying their first property, they are doing the Myrtle Beach, Branson, cheaper, you know, 250 and under thing or 400 and under thing if they can. So it's just, you know, it's a mixed mm-hmm. bag.
So, you know, we're in the Northeast and we meet a lot of people that, you know, at real estate meetups or people from our regular life that are not the short-term rental life that ask about these vacation markets. And, you know, as you're seeing in your markets, things are very expensive up here as well. You know, it's kind of hard to dodge this anywhere. You know, what is your advice for people that want to build that first or get into a short-term rental the first time? Like, would you steer them toward a market that might be distant, but that they can get a better return on? Or would you steer them in the direction of maybe a market? It doesn't have to be one of your markets, could be anything. A market that maybe they're more comfortable managing in, that they could actually see the property, use the property themselves, and kind of get their feet wet with this space.
I think it helps in a very major way if you buy in a market that you understand and buy a property that you like. So a big part of managing and running short-term rentals is authenticity. And, you know, if you're buying up a bunch of junky properties in a Midwestern city, not to hate on the Midwest, but, you know, in any small city or big city, if you're buying up a bunch of junky properties, just specifically numbers wise, just because the numbers look good, your guests are going to be able to tell. But if you're buying, like if you really want to own that property in Sunapee, New Hampshire, and you really want to be on that lake and that's your dream and you love this property, people can tell because you care more about it. You care more about the property and you care more about the guests renting your property because you love it and you want them to have a good time in it. So I would say start with something that you're familiar with and something that you like yourself, because if you don't like it, your guests are going to be able to tell, and why would they have any respect for your property either?
Yeah, that's great advice. Have you been to Mount Sunapee? Have you skied there?
No, I haven't.
No, it's great. I mean, I'm not a huge skier, but I have skied at Sunapee a bunch. And when you get to the summit, you can see both, there's like Little Lake Sunapee, or there's 2 Lake Sunapees there. But, you know, those New Hampshire markets, people, as I mentioned earlier, people have been going to Lake Winnipesaukee and Sunapee and Sebago Lake in Maine, you know, for generations. And vacation houses have been passed down through the years. People are still buying new. I still see the forums both on Facebook and on places like BiggerPockets about people, you know, comparing notes and seeing like how bookings are looking. You know, where are things today in, we're recording this in 2024, you know, and we went through the whole Airbnb bus thing, whatever it's called, which I don't agree with either. I think that you won't agree that that actually happened, because personally, we had our best year ever last year. So I think that's probably the case for a lot of people that are doing this correctly. Where do you see things headed in the short-term rental market? Like not just this year and in future years, like why should somebody still kind of get into this asset class?
Short-term rentals are the easiest thing to finance for the most amount of money. And I've been roasted on my Instagram for this before, but listen to me. It's a lot easier to get finance. People are like, they don't just give you the financing. And I'm like, if you qualify, they just give it to you. So it's easier, much easier to qualify and get financing for a single family conventional home, single family conventional loan than an apartment building of the same price. So if you're going to buy a $1.5 million single family, that's easier to get financing for than a $1.5 million, you know, 10 unit multifamily, because when you're getting a conventional or a DSCR loan, it goes, you know, you have to qualify, you have to have enough money. But when you move over to commercial, they want to see a lot more. So they want to see, your business plan, your track record. If you're brand new and you're buying your first one, you're probably not going to be able to get a commercial loan because they're not as widely available. You can walk into any bank or mortgage broker in the country and apply for a conventional loan. You have to go to a local bank or credit union to get a commercial loan. The property is going to have to be local, or you're going to have to be local. So you can't live in Florida and buy something in Texas and expect, you know, the Bank of Montana to give you a loan on that. They've got no skin in that game. They're going to want you to put a bunch of money in their bank. They want to create a relationship. They want to see that you're planning to buy multiple with them. So if you're just planning to buy one in this market, not going to work. So it's much easier to just go get a conventional single family home loan than to go get commercial financing. So you're able to get into that cash flow game faster to make the same amount of money for an easier loan than if you were to go the commercial route. So for me, it's the easiest way to get started for the most amount of cash flow, which is why I started, than really anything else. You know, if you buy a single family long-term, you're looking at a few hundred bucks a month. So it's definitely my favorite way, especially for people who are new, who want to get into real estate. I think it's the best way to get started because it's the most amount of money the fastest. And you'll also, you know, it'll tell you whether it's for you or not pretty quickly as well.
Yeah. Early on, it almost wasn't for us. Like we were tested early on at our first two properties, like within the first couple of guests, that I almost want to throw my hands up. But you know what? I stuck through it. And here we are, you know, 27 times super host, and I don't know how many hundreds of reviews that we've had, but we did what you were recommending. You know, like, it's the easiest way to get financing for a property. You know, so what we did, we talk about our story all the time: second home loan, HELOC, construction loan, another HELOC. And then we did commercial financing once we kind of started to hit our limit. And then we did the DSCR loan for the next one. And then we did a commercial line of credit, you know, but we graduated into all these things, not knowing what they all were. You know, it's just like you work with someone for the first time and they're like, you know, I have this job. My spouse has this job. You know, we think we can qualify for another loan for a second home. Go for it. That's where you start, right? You know, get that first property under your belt.
Exactly.
We've also recommended, you know, looking to places that, and so we're not agents in the short-term rental space, but like people that ask about this, I say, look where you want to go. You know, like if you're going to be really hands-on with your property, because you're going to want to decorate it yourself, you're going to want to use it, bring your kids there, whatever. Why don't you find a market that you actually want to be in? You know, find a property that you wouldn't mind driving to or spending some time with your family. Because guess what? You know, unless you find the systems to have somebody self-manage it or manage it from afar, you're probably going to self-manage this thing and you're going to be in that market. So you might as well be somewhere that you want to be.
Exactly.
Okay. So short-term shop, you guys are expanding, or are you expanding? Like what's happening next with you guys?
We are always looking for new markets that might make sense. So, if you are listening and you're an agent in a vacation market somewhere in the country that we are not, definitely hit me up. It's avery@theshorttermshop.com. So we're always kind of expanding, not doing anything major right this second, but if something makes sense, we'll absolutely open there.
And what, as a podcast host, or as a host, I should say, I almost don't want to say podcast host, because short-term show is more than just a podcast. You know, it's led to speaking engagements and whatnot for you. What have you learned over the years of hosting your own program?
Really that there are just 1,000 ways to be successful in real estate. And, you know, what I thought, I mean, things that I would never do, people have come on my show and done, have been really successful with. So it's kind of taught me to keep an open mind when it comes to strategies in real estate, because there's been times that I've told a client, like, please don't buy this. Like, I don't think this is a good idea. Let's not buy it. And they buy it anyway, and then they crush it. So there really are just 1,000,000 ways to be successful in real estate and a million different strategies. And that's probably been my biggest takeaway. There's no right one or two or three right ways to do it.
And along that line, like kind of building up your brand and your presence online and landing on, you know, large speaker stages for large real estate investor conferences, like how has that changed your life and your world? Or what got you interested in doing that? And what have you learned about being in some of these rooms?
Oh, I don't know if I was ever interested in doing that. I'm a hardcore introvert. And so the speaking on stages doesn't bother me at all. But, you know, just being in rooms full of big people, I'm like, oh, my battery is depleting. So, I mean, that just kind of feels like, honestly, a glitch in the matrix. Just been doing my thing to try to not have that corporate job that I hated, and to be able to, we knew we wanted to have kids, and when we started this, we didn't have them at the time. And my goal was to not have to, put my kids in daycare from 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock in the evening when I got off. My goal was to give them the experience of stay-at-home parents while not having stay-at-home parents. And that's, kind of what we've done is we're done working every day by 2 o'clock. Somebody's going to get one kid, somebody's going to get the other kid, or maybe we'll both go get both, like the Clampets. For me, all of the rest of it, like the speaking engagements and the things, just kind of feels like a glitch in the matrix, to be honest.
It's funny how it just kind of happens, right? And then you just fall into the space, and then the more of them that you do and you do well with them, then other people keep asking you to be part of, whatever event they're doing or to come on a podcast like this. But before we ask the final couple questions, I want to throw some kind of law question here since we are the Real Estate Law Podcast. Rory is not here. He's off doing a closing right now, actually. But I don't think you're an attorney, right? But you said you had a master's degree.
No, I'd love to be an attorney, though. I feel like I missed my calling with that.
Really interesting. Okay, we've talked to a lot of attorneys on this where they're like, "Oh, I don't know why I got into this space." So, what are some things as a non-attorney that you recommend maybe a new client might consider speaking to an attorney about during the process of either acquiring a short-term rental or starting up a short-term rental?
Definitely your asset protection and your plan, if you happen to die, who gets things not going into probate, how you need to set everything up so that if something happens, you're either, whether something is that you die or that someone dies on your property, that you are protected in the best way possible. And I think that's a conversation for both an attorney and a CPA. So you need both of those people. And you want to do that. You don't need to necessarily do all that stuff before you buy your first one, because you want to just at least get your feet wet and get going. But it is something that you need to do pretty quickly after you get going to make sure that you're not doing things wrong. And talk to a real attorney first. Don't go on like LegalZoom or something for $1,500 to save money, because it's going to cost you more later to have an attorney unwind all the stuff you did wrong when you're setting up your LLCs by using just the online platforms. So real attorneys, real CPAs, as quickly as possible once you get up and running.
Yeah, excellent advice. All right, so let's start with the final three questions before we wrap things up and learn where people can get a hold of you. First one is something that you've probably done, but maybe you have a different answer for this one than the standard answer we all think that we're going to get from you. If you can get on stage for a half hour, talk about any subject in the world with zero preparation, what would that be?
Oh, classic rock for sure.
All right. Now, you said you know all the lyrics to all the songs for about 3 decades, from 1960 to
Almost
1992.
everything.
I'm not going to test you with this, and I do believe you. But like, are there any is there any anyone that you have not had a chance to see that you really wish you saw in their heyday?
In their heyday, there are several who, like, I mean, David Bowie didn't get to see
Yeah.
that. Didn't see the Ramones. Luke saw the Ramones. I'm very jealous of that. Who else? I mean, I would have liked to have seen the Runaways in their heyday. I've seen both Joan and Lita now, but
Yeah.
would have liked to have seen them back then.
Joan's still touring. I think she's touring with Green Day this summer. I think they're going to play Fenway
Oh, I think
Park.
it's Alanis Morissette, because I really
Oh,
want
is
to
it?
take my daughter, but I don't want to have to, I just want to go see Joan Jett. I don't really care about Alanis Morissette. Like,
Yeah, yeah. Fenway
that.
concerts are pretty cool. We've seen Foo Fighters there twice. I've seen the Police. I've seen a bunch of shows there. And my answer to that question, in case anyone cares, it's right there. INXS.
Oh yeah,
That's the
it's easy.
band. That's the band that I wish I'd seen in their heyday. All right. Second question we have for you. Tell us something that happened early in your life or career that impacts the way that you're working today.
I would have to say athletics. So as somebody who, played music for so long, people are either like on the art side or the athletic side, and they don't cross over. I make sure that both of my kids cross over. They're in soccer, tennis, everything, piano, theater. But anyway, athletics really did, and maybe it's not going to be like this for this generation, because I think, my generation was the last generation where coaches were like real assholes, and like you can't have water, kids like having heat strokes, and that was okay. They're not going to give you water to make you tough, but just it's helped me in the terms of understanding that working hard, you know, for an end goal will get you somewhere. And then also just so hard work and then being able to deal with difficult personalities. So I was screamed at from 8 to 22 by middle-aged to old men, and sometimes women, usually men though. So like clients can't hurt my feelings. Like, you know, people kind of turn into the worst version of themselves in real estate transactions. It's a big deal. It's a lot of money. It can impact the rest of your life. And people get kind of difficult and they get mean and they say things they don't mean because they're nervous. And so I've gotten really good at handling difficult clients because of being screamed at in athletics for my whole life. So mm-hmm. I would say athletics.
Awesome. Yeah. What an amazing answer. And, you know, way to take that experience from the past that's deep down inside of you and, like, you know, bring that into your professional world too. Final question. Tell us something you're listening to or watching or reading these days. Anything in the world.
Listening to, we're taking the kids to see the Rolling Stones in Atlanta in mm-hmm. June. And so every morning during breakfast, I am playing one Rolling Stones record in order of importance to me. Not necessarily importance to the public, and you know, making sure that they're getting like super hyped and know all the words and are ready to go see that in June with us.
What was the first album that you played of theirs for your kids?
So I have a kind of unconventional Stones favorite. I like Emotional Rescue. I know a lot of people don't like that record. Yeah. I love Emotional Rescue. And She's So Cold is my favorite song from that. And the first time I got to see the Stones was at Zilker Park in Austin in 2006, and it was general admission. And during She's So Cold, I got a cameo on the Biggest Bang DVD because I'm sitting on my friend's shoulder hollering at Keith. And for a second, the camera pans to me. And so that's like my claim to fame. I was on a Rolling Stones DVD.
You have a lot more claim to fames now, you know, beyond that. But was Emotional Rescue, was that like the disco years, like the late 70s, like that came out? Kind of that vibe?
It was right before, I believe it was right before Tattoo You.
Tattoo You, I think was like 80 or 81 or something, I feel like. Because I remember that was on MTV. That was Start Me Up, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the early days of MTV. I'm also dating myself now, too. So I definitely have a couple more years in my teeth than you do. Avery, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. If people want to get a hold of you, we'll put all your stuff in the show notes. But what's the easiest way to learn more about what you do, what Short Term Shop does, and how to say hi?
Yeah, you can follow us on Instagram and YouTube. It's at The Short Term Shop on Instagram and / The Short Term Shop on YouTube. Or, of course, you can come to our website and you can get in touch with us there. Like, if you want to work with us, we've got all of our, you can set up a search for any of the markets that we're in to find real estate. You can get in touch with agents, everything at theshorttermshop.com.
Or go to many of the short-term rental conferences or real estate conferences. You might see Avery on the big stage, but then she'll go into her hotel room afterward because she is that extrovert introvert that a lot of us are in this space. Yeah. If you have enjoyed this episode, we'd love 5-star reviews. We love your comments. Please, right away, go to realestatelawpodcast.com if you want to be a guest of the podcast. And if you have a question for Avery, don't want to ask her, ask me, and I'll ask her for you. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.